I won't be ignored. Yes, Linkin Park, Steve McCabe's favourite band. Do you get annoyed when people, gentlemen, feel completely free to consult their mobile phones during conversations? This snubbing using a phone is called fubbing, and now a Stop Fubbing campaign group has started in Australia, and five other movements have apparently been following suit in Europe. And the campaign's creator says a group of mates and I were chatting when someone raised how annoying being ignored by people on mobiles was. Do you feel the same way?
Oh, shocking. It's disgraceful. End of Western civilization as we know it. It's appalling.
The environment I work in, this is pretty commonplace, I must say, that everyone's got a mobile phone, and that they're more than happy to let you know that they're pretty important, and this call that's coming through is a bit more important than you are. So and I guess I'm a bit immune to it.
But that what you just said, Duncan, that's a bit that really, really grates, is what you're being told is, this thing in my hand is more important than you, the person I'm actually speaking to face-to-face. And that just feels like a slap.
Have you found it to be common?
Oh, common as muck. Yes, common in so many possible senses of the word. It's disgraceful. I was working back, before I went back to teaching, I was working in the United States. In retail, I was actually working in a mall, and there was nothing that I used to find more offensive than having a customer come across, ask you a question, and in the middle of the answer, the phone would ring. And they pull the phone out of the pocket, answer it, and I think, well, fair enough, then the conversation's over, and I turn to walk away, and this raised the finger. As if to say, no, stay. You're not going anywhere. I'll be back with you in a second, but don't leave yet. And I think, you know...
Did you raise a finger as well?
The same finger, yes. it's extraordinarily insulting, isn't it?
I said, but what do they all do on that? Because I was sitting at the airport at the weekend, and I was buried in the mobile, to be truthful, and so was everybody else. And no one actually seemed to be watching the world go by. This is the trouble, isn't it? I mean, what do they all do after you've replied to your texts? They're all probably just aimlessly wandering
across
the internet.
Well, Jim, you tell us, what were you doing?
I was aimlessly, after I'd finished polishing off the text replies, I started wandering across the websites, and then I caught myself doing that, and I put the phone away.
Oh, yeah. They're quite addictive. I mean, they're designed to be addictive. Have you got Word with Friends on your apps? That's a great little game of Scrabble you can play across the internet. That's my particular vice with it.
Oh, something else to do. That's great. Oh.
I shall have to send you an invitation for a game, Duncan.
Okay, there you go. Excellent.
That's what they're doing, isn't it? They're playing games, mostly. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's Facebook, and then you go check Twitter, and then you've got to update Twitter with, I've just checked Facebook here at the airport. It's self-perpetuating, and it does create a dependency on this.
Is it still rude, though? Because people don't seem to think it's rude, fubbing. You know, as you say, they're talking to you, and they're just kind of glancing down a bit and making sure things are fine with the phone.
Yeah, I'll talk to you for the time being, but I'm going to keep my options open in case something more interesting than you comes up. It's for not even the word sounds rude. It's shocking.
Yeah, that's clearly rude.
All right, thank you. May I run through the weekend schoolboy rugby results just quickly? This is in connection with something we discussed recently.
If we said no.
Well, no, seeing you're on the panel, actually. The business of handing out scholarships to boys to play rugby and or spending lots of money to make your rugby team better. And, of course, there's been a conversation up and down the country, I think I noticed in various media, about the St Kent's first 15 in Auckland, the world champions, top of the 1A contest, and they've won all those games on the trot. Anyway, at the weekend, Southland boys beat John McGlashan 50-0, I understand.
Wow.
John McGlashan remains a top private school in the South. Otago Boys High School beat Christ's College 19-16 in the very important clash that coincided with the Otago Boys High School 150th anniversary. Does anyone think less of Christ's College? This is the discussion, really. Are we concentrating too much on, would you send your child to a school because the rugby team was the top one? Does it make any difference, really, to schools?
I really don't think my daughter cares that much.
Well, I've got three boys, and one of them would. And the interesting thing is that I wouldn't send a child to a school because it's good at rugby, but children will select a school. And that, at least in my little world, that's actually quite an important thing, that I want the kid to go to a school that they want to go to as well. And certainly there are children out there that the sporting prowess of the school that they go to is really important. And I do know that there are certainly a number of people who adults with children who that's important to as well. It really is relevant for some people.
Okay, but is it a sort of American glory culture being imported here? Because the Americans have been doing all this for yonks, haven't they?
Well, it's deeply problematic, I think, that, you know, well, it's wrong at a number of levels. Wrong because it doesn't feed into the actual quality of the school at all, and it may in fact do the reverse because it's focusing on the wrong things. And the other thing is it's not even good for the sport, because some schools are equipped, you know, these top schools that are, play the top first 15 cup, some of them are equipped to go out and entice boys who are really good, and it does nothing for good rugby across all of the schools, particularly the schools without the money, the state schools that might not have, you know, huge money to throw at coaches or scholarships or whatever, which, absent this kind of behaviour, would have a perfectly good rugby team that could participate at the same level with the other schools. But it's not going to happen because it's, the money in it skews the results. And I don't accept that it's hard work, lots of training and good coaching.
No, and I know it's the American model that's being brought up as the one that's the cause for concern here. And what I see in New Zealand is something that's very, very different from the American high school sports culture, where it is an enormous industry in and of itself. And for many people, high school sports, and in particular college and university level sports, is bigger than professional sports. People yeah. have more passionate tribal allegiance to their college football team than they ever will to their local professional team. And this comes out of high school. My local high school, when I lived in Clearwater in Florida, local, you know, Countryside High School, with its fantastically named team, the Countryside Cougars. And it was wonderful. You see a lot of the mothers of the players would show up with sweatshirts with the word Cougar written across the chest. It was highly entertaining. And they were spending millions and millions of dollars on these matches. It'd be huge events. You'd drive past the field on a Friday evening. The floodlights were on. The stands would be full of spectators, have all paid in to watch the match. And there was a large amount of sponsorship going on. And a lot of these high schools, the graduates, would then start giving donations based upon how well the teams had done. So it was an enormous money spinning effort. And then it would then, for these kids, feed them then into universities who would also recruit them, not on their academic ability, but on their sporting ability.
But they've got 300 million people, haven't they?
And indeed.
And you wonder how many of the... And I know that some of our young men from these first 15s are going on to have rugby careers, and they're eyed up quite early on. But, I mean, how many of them, compared with the Americans, will really make a top career out of professional rugby? That's the difference, isn't it?
Probably not. And so a lot of this is being done for the benefit of the school rather than for the benefit of the kids, which is a bit unfair because, there's a reason why these schools are willing to invest the several-digit sums of money in each individual student. And when I taught in Japan, I saw that... where this leads to, I was required to supervise an exam for the economics department at the university I was teaching at. And in the lecture theatre, there's rows and rows of kids doing exams, and the majority of them are sitting there beavering away with their pencils, writing notes and drawing little supply and demand curve graphs or whatever. Yeah. And down the front, there was these three very large lads who had just put their heads down on their desks 5 minutes into the exam. And I'm just doing the thing, walking around the room. I walked past, and I looked at their exam papers, and they'd simply written the words rugby club at the top of their exam paper and then gone to sleep.
Oh, that's a pity.
Absolutely true.
People make the point that, you know, schools award scholarships in other areas, and so why not rugby? But, I mean, you don't poach violinists to make the orchestra great, do you? You don't hear about that happening a lot.
Not so often, no.
Oh, in moderation, I can understand that if you had a rugby scholarship to go along with the soccer scholarship and the violin scholarship and the drama scholarship, that would be fine. Yeah. But the just... absolute laser-like intensity of the focus in some of these schools on rugby is just, it's not useful. And it glorifies, you know, and I came from a school that had a bit of focus on this, it glorifies rugby to the expense of everything else. Everyone else who's good at things are in fact second-class citizens in some regard.
Otago Boys came from behind with that result against Christ College, I've got to say, before we leave the topic now.
Are we in any way biased or not interested particularly here?
Absolutely not.
No, not
totally impartial observer.
Had a feeling.
Now, the notion of privacy has been the main national discussion point until the Fonterra news broke, and in the last week we've been talking about the cameraman who recorded the John Key T-tapes having his phone records released, as well as the phone records business of Andrea Vance, the journalist who broke the GCSB story. And I suppose the basic discussion point underneath all this is whether our privacy is just more or less being casually ignored now. And former Privacy Commissioner Sir Bruce Slane will join us on this shortly. So the obvious question about this is, should the cameraman who recorded and released the T-tapes, should he have had the right to have his privacy breached? As the lawyer on the panel, Duncan, what's your opinion on this?
I'm flabbergasted, is my opinion. I find it absolutely surprising and disturbing that this kind of information seems to be so not only so readily available, that's actually probably not as surprising as the fact that it's actually obtained and considered. Because, you know, I was under the naive illusion that we lived in a society where things like this were governed by rights and by law and that everyone was subject to it. And it just seems this whole privacy, the focus on privacy that seems to have gone has utterly undermined my faith that, in fact, we can rely on people in places of power to respect the law even when they're not being watched, because that's what seems to have gone on here.
Steve?
Well, nobody ever listens to anything I say anyway, so I don't think it really applies to me too much. It is very, very odd that we seem to have allowed this to happen creepingly and progressively. And I think it's because we're not specifically aware. If you have somebody sitting in the room next to you saying, "Can you say that again, please? I didn't quite catch it." Then you're very, very aware that your privacy is being violated. Because it's being done without our knowledge, without our explicit conscious knowledge, we've allowed it to happen. And so suddenly now it's being blown out into the open. Everyone's talking about it. We're suddenly starting to realise this has been going on for quite some time. Our privacy has been little by little eroded. And I do not for one second buy into the, "Well, if you've done nothing wrong, then you've got nothing to hide" argument. No, I don't accept that for a second. And frankly, anybody who is trying to promote any of these laws that say, yeah, let's keep on probing people's privacy. Can I please see your bank statements? Can I come and have a quick rummage through your underwear drawer, for example? You know, it's got nothing to hide.
Sir Bruce Slane, former Privacy Commissioner, joining us now. Bruce, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Thank you.
Steve.
Thank you for coming. Can you outline your main, because I'm assuming, concern on your part over the Bradley Ambrose release, for example, or investigation. Can you outline your main concern about it?
Yeah, I think the main thing is that normally is the communications between a individual and their lawyer, and here you've got the situation where in the past communication would be by letter or a phone conversation or something, but here is something retrievable later in the form of texts. And from what I can find out from my friends and colleagues, is there's no real protocol for this. The police just get a warrant. I assume they get a warrant. If they don't get a warrant, there's a provision in the Privacy Act that enables a telco to release information where it would be a prejudice to the maintenance of the law, is the quaint phrase they use. And that raises the question, should the telco ask questions of the police about why they want it and whatnot to satisfy themselves that the police need to get it? In fact, what happens is they just hand the whole lot over. And later, the lawyer, if there's a prosecution, or if they ask for it under the Privacy Act, gets all this transcripts of these texts that have been held by the police. And the police can't use those texts in evidence, but they can use them to say, this is what their defence is going to be. This is the direction we should go and have a look at so-and-so. And I understand that there is a case at the moment pending where the evidence was obtained as a result of looking at a privileged communication, and the judge has to decide whether that evidence should be admitted in the case. But on the privacy aspect, then the information is there, and I think the lawyers and the clients have to be aware that it can be picked up any time. And the latest protest banner in the United States is, "Yes, we can. Yes, we scan."
Yes, we scan. The police defence of this, am I being fair, is essentially, well, it could have been serious in terms of the investigation into Bradley Ambrose. Is that sufficient?
It doesn't sound a serious thing to me. Here was a completely artificially staged PR event in which, for some reason, they think two people sitting at a table makes a better picture than just one of them saying, "I support this bloke over here." And the conversation happened to be picked up. And as far as Steve's comment about nothing to hide is concerned, the Prime Minister must have had something to hide, because he got very agitated about it and called it news of the world and whatnot. But it wasn't a serious case. It was a conversation that they were having about platitudes rather than serious, intimate political discussion, just so they could be filmed doing it.
Yes, so it wasn't the crime of the century, even if it had been deliberate. That's what you're saying, basically.
Yeah,
it wasn't worth the police doing this.
This is not plotting terrorism or something or other.
Okay, so we seem to have a culture now, despite how often we all talk about it, of this kind of casual examination of your own private business. And it seems the stable door seems to have been bolted, doesn't it? I mean, this is now going on a lot.
Yes, and one of the objectives of the GCSB is to counter spying, cyber spying, from overseas commercial interests. So it's not just a nation-to-nation sort of thing that's being done. And that's why I think if you're going to have any oversight under the GCSB bill, it should be oversight of policy, not just to see whether the legal boxes have been ticked. Somebody should be looking and saying, are they doing sensible things or not, or are they intruding unnecessarily?
But obviously the temptation to delve into personal correspondence is very beguiling, entrancing and beckoning. And is that going to change? It's easy to do, and because it is easy to do and the access is there, can you really see an effective way of reversing that trend?
Yes, I think we've got to get away from the idea that if you concede some of your personal information in one area that, you've got no concern about hiding it for other or keeping it to yourself for other purposes. And that's rubbish. Yeah. Privacy isn't an absolute thing. It is something that you can concede for a particular purpose. So you go and tell your intimate health details to the health practitioner because that's to your advantage. It doesn't mean to say that you want the health practitioner passing it on to all and sundry. So I think that consciousness is there. And in the surveys that the Privacy Commissioner has done, there's about a 80 to 90% concern about what people are doing with our information. So there is a consciousness of people, and it differs in some people who are worried about their health information, others talk about little else. Some be worried about their financial information, what their income is or so. We've got our entitlements, and I think each needs to be protected.
Yes, but I'm sorry to labour this point, but if Edward Snowden is right and he reckons he could wiretap anybody anywhere in the world and learn just about everything about them by simply having their email address, if that exists now with this X key score, which is the latest word we've had to learn,
yes.
If that can be done, what can actually reverse the tide? That's the problem, isn't it? No matter how concerned we all are about it.
Yeah, I think you've got to, well, first of all, knowledge, which we've now got as a result of Edward Snowden, of knowledge of what's going on, and putting limits on the use of that data so that it can't be used for, if it's collected for security purposes, then it's not used for other purposes.
Okay, so
great dangers. If information's collected and used, it may be misused as well.
All right, so firm safeguards in law, you're saying.
And I think the Privacy Act here has been pretty good, and the Law Commission recommendations for improving it will make it better so that the commissioner can say, I order you to do not to do this, what you're doing at the moment, anymore, and there'll be severe penalties if you break that.
All right, thank you. Sir Bruce Slane on the panel. Steve and Duncan with us till 5, and just one more thing to discuss, really. Smokers, of course, have faced an array of legislation and constant tax increases and plain packaging and restrictions on where they can smoke. And now in Australia, out of the University of Sydney, comes the recommendation that smokers need a license to have a license to smoke, a smart card license to curb teenage smoking. And essentially, if you're 13, 14, 15, 16 and want to light up, you'd have to get a license, which would have to be checked by retailers. Does this seem like a sensible idea or not?
It seems like deja vu. Didn't we talk about something remarkably similar during the pre-panel show? Uruguayan marijuana? when you realise that prohibition isn't working. So you start to little by little feed out the rope of legitimisation. What we're basically saying here is, yeah, we know teenagers are going to smoke. We've tried everything in our power, from making it illegal to having horrible pictures to having "smoking will kill" written in huge great big letters over every single cigarette. So you name it. And still teenagers are smoking. Who'd have thought it? So now, well, we'll just make it legal. I think that's kind of where we're headed with this one.
Okay. Duncan, what's your take on this?
Well, I find this a really odd concept because it's not really licensing in the way we generally understand it. It's not like you have to take lessons or anything, you know, make sure you can inhale properly. It's really just, as has been said, a further constraint.
They do that behind the bike sheds at school, Duncan.
Well, maybe that's what it's getting at, you know, is that the environments that we learn how to smoke in is, you know, they teach us all the wrong habits. Maybe we need a drinking license and a few drinking lessons as well.
Well, no one's suggested that, have they? That's the difference.
but how would that work? If you spill your drink, do you lose your license?
Well, I suppose we do have a license to drink in a sense. We have an age of
drinking. Or if you serve your red wine chilled, does that get points on your license?
You probably should. But, I mean, it's just a further constraint, isn't it, on who can smoke and how you can go about smoking. And I suppose, ultimately, everyone who smokes would have to come up with their little plastic license saying, look, someone's sat me down and told me how evil this is, but I'm going to do it anyway. Look, here's the card that says I'm an idiot. You know, I'm guessing that's what's going on here. And maybe it's the shame of the thing. I mean, I think over time, smoking has become less and less acceptable, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
In fact, and I think culturally that's more and more the case. We can, people our age, I think we're all about the same age, can remember when, you know, perhaps you would go to a restaurant and people would actually be smoking there.
That was on planes, and absolutely. But does each increment, each increment seems sensible, doesn't it? This seems, on the face of it, and to many people it will seem to be a sensible idea, but does it build a suffocating society when you consider the totality of it?
Well, good choice of words, absolutely not, Jim. Not suffocating at all, quite the opposite, because at last we have clean air. In fact, I'm in court in Auckland on Wednesday, I think, arguing that we shouldn't be allowed to smoke and play pokies at the same time at the Sky City Casino. So there you go. I've got an interest on this one.
Is that because people can't multitask efficiently?
Well, there's a whole lot of reasons, not least because there's a good argument it's not an open area, it's just a big room they play pokies in.
Oh, that'll be an interesting day in court for you. Duncan Webb, thank you so much for joining us today. Steve McCabe, you too.
Thank you very much.
Checkpoint follows. Thanks, everybody. We are back tomorrow.